Spirit Radio Podcasts.
This week's budget was the largest in the history of the state, but I suppose extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures. But are they the right ones? With this massive injection of 18 billion euro, has the government targeted all the right areas, and how are we going to pay for it long term? And will they be able to wean themselves off the borrow and spend strategy in the longer term? Well, with me now to discuss the implications of this historic budget, I have economist Professor Ray Kinsella on the line. Ray, good to have you with us.
Thanks very much, Wendy. How are you?
Okay, so an 18 billion budget, 17.75 if we're to be precise. What's your reaction to it?
It's what they had to do, Wendy. It's a classic Keynesian response to an economy that's flatlining and where there are massive spare resources. So demand has collapsed. The capacity of firms to respond has been seriously impacted, and the whole social economy is under massive strain. So in my view, they did the right thing. They also did follow the path that has been strongly endorsed, not just by the EU, but by the IMF. I mean, this is a global shock. And when you look at the global response, the injection of, wait for it, 12 trillion.
It feels almost like monopoly money. The figures are so big, right?
It is. And that does reflect the scale of the shock, not just now, but into the future. I mean, this is a budget for next year as well. And again, when you look at the forecasts of the IMF, who are meeting at the moment, you know, they're saying two things that I think are really important for Ireland. It's not just the shock, it's the uncertainty. And in the case of Ireland, it's magnified because more than most countries, we're impacted by four things, Wendy. We're impacted by COVID, directly and indirectly. We see it all around us. We're impacted by the uncertainties of Brexit. One way or another, there will be a negative impact. We just don't know yet. I think there are two other areas that we haven't factored in. I mean, our economy is very dependent on multinational corporations. And down the line, immediately over the horizon of COVID and Brexit, there will be a major shake-up in corporate taxation that will hit us. And as I said earlier, our economy, our social economy, which is where people live and trade and bring their families, that's really strained. So given the uncertainties, given the fact that there is a shock all around the economy and in the world in which we live, yes, I think this was the right budget.
And in terms of just where the money is being spent, Ray, is it being kind of allocated in the right way? Because, I mean, obviously with every budget, you're always going to have so many different groups saying, you know, there should have been more money allocated here. You know, lots saying, where was there any funding for the childcare sector? As an example, of course, there's many examples. But when it's such a big budget, you kind of wonder, how do they not manage to please everybody?
Well, it is, except that, I was looking at some figures recently of the trend in deficits and borrowing in recent years. And this is really of the Richter scale. So it has given them the capacity to respond to issues and problems and bottlenecks, Wendy, that simply would not have been addressed in other years. And of course, this is because all of the restrictions imposed by the EU on our borrowing position, our deficit, our, all those kind of ratios, they're gone. And because the EU and the ECB has made funds available at zero cost. So it is a chance to address exactly the kind of issues you're saying, notably healthcare, education and housing. And it's important to remember that housing and healthcare were what cost them, both parties, the election. And I think there'd be a particular sensitivity to not getting it wrong or not going in big enough. Having said that, I wouldn't criticise.
But I suppose, from the healthcare perspective, Ray, and it's something that we've talked about, just our health system and the way that it's failing. We've talked about it before on the show. Is the investment going to help us to catch up on the underinvestment there has been in the past? And then what happens, you know, in a budget 4 or 5 years down the road when there's a certain expectation of spending and that won't be there anymore?
There are two issues there, Wendy, and both of them are really important. Let's be categorical. The amount of underinvestment in the healthcare system in recent years was a scandal. capital expenditure in terms of capacity, hospital capacity, and particularly if you go back to March, April, the under-provision of ICU beds, the understaffing, all of that was the build-up of what had been underinvested in previous years. Now, I think they've used the largesse that's been available to them to address those issues. And if you look at where they're proposing to spend the money, staffing, waiting lists, capacity. One area that I think, a point that has been made by Mr. Jimmy Sheehan, who is vocationally and every other way, I mean, he is, in my view, the main expert, he's pointed out that many of our hospitals are beyond their sell-by date. So we tend to do something of a band-aid on them. It does fall for consideration whether, when the funds were available, we should not have looked systematically at all of the big hospitals and the smaller ones, Wendy, because another problem that has arisen from the last 5 or 10 years is parts of the country, places like Roscommon, they're 2 hours away from the hospital. So I think there was a chance there, an opportunity to look at rapid access systems. But having said that, those are things they could have done. But I think it would be wrong to be negative about what they have done.
In terms of just another area, which is obviously just things like shoring up social welfare payments, the pub payments, all that sort of stuff, Fiona Sheehan of the Irish Independent described the budget as the expansion of the big state. I guess he was alluding to the fact that maybe this budget could create a dependence culture. What do you think?
I think he's right. But going back to your previous questions, it's really important. The impact of COVID was to crowd out very necessary non-elective treatments. We know that. We know that the hospitals were emptied and that people, in terms of cancer treatments and various other types of treatments, were pushed out. And I think there is a recognition of that written into the budget to say we really have to catch up with these, because you know what? People are dying for lack of access. We just don't see it. And I think that is an important factor. But regarding what Finan says, again, he's right. I mean, this is the biggest intervention ever in the history of the state. And it comes with significant interventions in our lives and the way we engage with the world. For Christians, most notably in the area of closing churches. And I would have to be convinced in terms of the evidence for closing churches as a possible locus for clusters.
Yeah, we're still the only country in Europe that is denying public worship.
Well, I think that's really important, and I've made that point elsewhere. If there is evidence that there are clusters of infection that arise from churches being open, they should be published, and the Taoiseach should have said it, and the healthcare committee should have said it. They haven't done that. And I think in a social economy where solidarity, empathy, people coming together responsibly, bringing God into the equation, because we have to look at this in the way people are. People are grieving and worried and fearful, and that's the important role the churches play. You know, there are those kind of pressures in there, and they won't be solved purely by throwing money at the problem, nor will they be solved by having a massive state that is permanently there. And look, there will be an increase in dependence. It's happened already. It is, economic theory and policy tells us that it's easy to spend money, notoriously in budgets, it's way, way difficult, more difficult to rein it back if and when the good times come.
That's the thing, yeah, to be able to kind of row back in it. But then the big question is, Ray, and I know that probably people listening at the moment are thinking of their children, who is going to pay for this in the long term?
Two things. The assumption is that once the economy gets beyond 2021, that it will recover. Now, I'm not convinced of that looking at the forecasts, because there may be a strong second and third wave. It will be time before the kind of infrastructure of a global economy on which we so depend starts functioning again properly. And, you know, people's expectations change. the way we behave and consume and spend change. But the government's assumption is that if we get through this, the economy will begin to recover, there will be more revenues paid in, and also the EU is making massive funds available to simply get through the next 2 years. It's a gamble. It's a gamble they had to take, given the uncertainty and given the fear. And I wouldn't criticise them for that. I think it's...
So you think the government has struck the right balance here. But then I suppose thinking, Ray, now what's happened with level three restrictions being extended, level four in border counties, is the economic situation, even with this budget, going to get worse before it gets better?
Well, I think the... Yeah, I mean, the main determinant on how the economy will perform is less Brexit, and it's much more on not only the pandemic itself, but the policy responses to it. And, you know, there's a huge debate globally about whether or not those kind of close downs works. Now, one of the issues that people are not picking up on is the restrictions are so damn complex. And I think, you know, people genuinely worry about how many in a family and how often and under what conditions. There's a lack of transparency there. And I suppose from a citizen's point of view, a parent's point of view as well, it seems that a lot of the problems are arising from people who are engaging in social activities that are not necessary and are being irresponsible. Now, you know, that's something that the Taoiseach has mentioned. He's right to mention it. It almost defies belief that you would find social activities in such a situation where, frankly, people don't seem to give a damn, but at the cost of other people's livelihoods as well as lives. So the big thing is, how quickly can we get back to some kind of normalcy? How much of an impact will it have on our rights as citizens to engage in social activities, including the opening of our churches? But we won't see that really until it's over. And we've
Indeed.
Come out the other side, hopefully.
Well, Ray, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Ray Kinsella, who is an economist and also author of the book Troikonomics. Spirit. Well, it's probably one of the big decisions that hits you, and it comes around faster than you imagine it will in terms of sending your child to big school. And you mightn't think of it when you're first pregnant in terms of the birth month and the influence that might have on your decision. I, for example, my son Matthew, my eldest, he is born in February. So my choice is, and I'm seeing online through different chats, lots of parents find themselves in this position. Do they send their child when they're going to be the youngest in the class or oldest in the class? And what's the best way to make that decision? And is there a difference between boys and girls? And with primary school admissions just around the corner, we thought it'd be a good time to talk about it with my next guest, child psychologist Patricia Fitzpatrick. Patricia, thanks for joining us on the programme today.
You're welcome, Wendy. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with how important is this decision in terms of when to start a child at school?
I think it is very important, Wendy. And since prior to my first child starting school, which is about 35 years ago now, I made this decision based on a book I had read, and I can't think of the woman's name, Mary somebody, who had educated all her children at home herself. Now, I'm glad I didn't do that, but I know I rang her about something and I told her my son would be starting school, and he was born. It's really interesting because you say Matthew is February. I have two Februaries. I have a January and I have an April. And on this occasion, my son was four in the April, and I said to her he'd be starting school, and she said, "Oh my God, you wouldn't send a four-year-old to school." And he was my first, so that really put the cat among the pigeons. So I didn't, and I've never regretted that decision.
And what sort of wisdom do we have now on it, Patricia? Because there has been a lot of change in that, you know, the research shows that at that time, you know, when you were thinking of sending your child to school when they were four, you weren't alone. The average age years ago was four, but what happened was children ended up being held back. But now the average age seems to be closer to five because of the ECI scheme. But how do you know? Is there indicators that you should look for? If there is someone in that boat where they're saying, well, is it better for them to be the youngest or the oldest?
I would say very definitely the oldest. And Wendy, if you look at this, this huge development happens, you know, in the child's early life. And I also remember a number of years ago a programme, Dispatches, on Channel 4, where they were, in England the children have to be in school, if I'm right, at 4. In Ireland, by 6 they have to be in school, the law states. But they went around the classroom and they followed little people, and it was heart-wrenching to see them not able to keep up and really actually saying themselves, I can't do it. So, you know, their self-esteem at that early stage been damaged. But, you see, there's so much to it. You know, a child develops socially, emotionally, spiritually, cognitively. Now, if you look at the cognitive part of it, you know, that's where their understanding, their attention, their ability to follow commands and instructions, that develops hugely between age 4 and age 5. And I really feel so sorry for the little people who go to school at 4. And, you know, a child, you know yourself with your own two, you know, their attention span improves all the way along. So a little person being able to attend in the class, you know, it's a big, big thing, because you're in a class with maybe 30 or more other children. So if you're somebody who's age 4 and you're less able to attend, you're less able to sit down, you're less able to take the commands, you're going to get more of the negative attention.
In terms of what do you say to a parent, Patricia, where, because as you say, there's so many different elements, you know, there's the social and emotional, but what do you say to a parent who says, okay, my son or daughter's been in preschool for 2 years, they're way ahead, let's say, in their literacy and their numeracy, obviously the emotional side maybe hasn't caught up, but they're worried they're going to be bored if they delay it another year?
Well, I worry very much if preschool or play school, I prefer to call it, or play group, if it's all about numeracy and literacy. You know, children learn through play. And what's really important is that they're allowed to develop creatively and imaginatively. And, you know, if you look to the continent, Wendy, they don't send the children. You see, school is formal learning. The continent don't they're in kindergarten, which is much more informal. Formal learning does not start there until children are about 6 or 7. And they, you know, they may be behind a little bit then in their numeracy or the literacy, but they will catch up. So I think it's far more important that the child is able to, you know, is able to partake. You see, if you think of the three, first of all, the social, being able to mix with the friends, the emotional, you know, being able to express how they feel about things, and then the cognitive. You know, if those three aren't, if the children are behind there, as or appropriately as they are at age 4, their behaviour may be, you know, their behaviour won't be, or usually won't be, the same as you'd expect from a 5-year-old. So again, as I said, that child's going to get more negative attention in the class. And that's not, this is nothing against the teacher. Teachers have a really, really difficult job to do. Also, it's the time, you know, big school, it's a longer day. And I can say to you, Wendy, from having been there many years ago, having a child, once I made the decision. And I say this to all parents, it's a very personal thing, but it is backed up by you know, empirical evidence. But once I made the decision, I didn't send any of my children to school until there were 5. And my youngest was 5 in the January. And none of them struggled at school. You see, so I would prefer you send the child to school at 5. That child is going to much more likely be in the top half of the class. You know, that's not to say that some 4-year-olds won't be in the top half of the class, but they're much more likely to be there. Again, if you talk to...
And is there a difference between boys and girls in terms of their development?
Yeah, people say that, but I didn't find it with mine. The one thing with boys, I don't know if you're familiar with Stephen Biddle, the Australian psychologist who's written Raising Boys. He's also written Raising Girls. But I'm a fan of his. And one of the things that he would say about boys... that I don't think is that we've paid enough attention to. Boys are emotionally boys up to about age 3. He wouldn't have a boy separated from its mother. Now, I know it could be very controversial here, and he could be, before age 3, because emotionally boys tend to be, and I would have seen that myself, they tend to be that little bit, you know, girls are able to manage things better at an earlier stage. Boys are that little bit, I think, emotionally behind a little bit. So, but at the same time, I didn't discriminate between boys and girls. And I think, you know,
And does it matter, Patricia, what about the makeup of the class? Like, so let's say you put your child down, their name down, and you discover that, well, actually this year, for whatever reason, they are all closer to 4.5 or closer to 5.5 or whatever it is. Does that matter in terms of the age difference?
I don't think so. And I would err on the side of 5, because your child is going to be so much more able for what... It's a big thing. It's a big step. they're away from home for whatever, 5 hours in the day. You know, they're expected to behave. And I think sometimes now there's a lot of anxiety out there with little people and, you know, when they get a little bit older. And I do wonder sometimes that children, there's so much expected of them nowadays.
And is it fair to say then, if they are kind of learning through play and doing, say, like in a play-based Montessori environment, you kind of can't do too much of that? Will they get bored doing that?
You see, again, I would question there what is happening in that. You know, play, children learn through play. And I just, if a child, if they're saying, oh, they're bored or, you know, they're not, I just wonder, well, what are you expecting of them? What is, and years ago, Wendy, I was part of a community play group. And, you know, we had, you know, the main things a child needs at that age, they need sand, they need Play-Doh, you know, they need dress-up boxes, they need jigsaws, they need some organized stuff as well too, but very little of it. But it's amazing to watch them and you need, you know, adults there who are going to supervise and facilitate rather than be didactic. So I worry sometimes that maybe we're gone too much to pushing our children ahead. You know, this helicopter parenting, as opposed to letting things. And there's a number of societal reasons for that. And
letting them play, letting them be. There's enough years for kind of very formal education. I just want to get to a message from a listener, Patricia, which is talking about saying, my daughter, like Wendy's, is going to be, like Wendy's son, I presume, like is going to be either 4.5 or 5.5, but she's really far ahead, has the same verbal abilities as children that are age 6 or older. I am worried that she's going to be bored, but I'm really nervous I'm going to make the wrong decision for her. There's a lot of parents in that position where they're saying, you know, my gut might say one thing, but then seeing the child says another.
Yeah, and I would say there, Wendy, you know, keep her to age 5.5. She's going to fly ahead. That was my experience. School will be a more enjoyable place for her. Self-esteem will build, you know. I'm really, it's one of the things, Wendy, that I'm very convinced of.
And do people, Patricia, not think further down the road? Like at the moment, you know, you're just thinking of how they are now. But obviously the age you send your child to primary school will impact the age that they start secondary school. And the difference between, say, starting first year at 12.5 or 13.5, it cannot be a case of, well, first of all, our children are already having to grow up too fast, and then they're having to grow up even faster still.
Exactly. And you know, Wendy, they're talking about that parent who talks about her child being very far ahead, and that's great. But in my experience, again, when you have a child who is very far ahead in one area, they may be a little bit behind in another. Now, look, some people are just, you know, flying ahead in every area. But again, in my experience, they can be a little bit behind socially or emotionally. You know, so like the school should be a place, first of all, where the child feels comfortable. If we're comfortable, if we feel, you know, safe, we will learn. If we're not, if we feel under pressure, you know, and there is such a thing as, you know, a little bit of pressure needing to be there, but not too much. So I'm, and again, when parents ask me about this, I say to them, look, this is my personal opinion on this, but it is backed up by my own personal experience and by other empirical evidence.
And of course, lots of Scandinavian countries, children don't start formal education until 6 or 7.
Exactly, Wendy. And look, you know, let our children have their childhoods. Yes, the adults need to facilitate. I think we all need to, and it looks a lot of schools now, and fair play to them, they're getting in more, I think, to the facilitation model rather than didactic. You know, how do we learn? We learn by exploring. We learn by being encouraged. We learn, and you will know yourself for having talked to me before, Wendy, maybe we haven't dealt with this one, but I really want parents to, you know, from a very young age, realize that your child has the answer to a lot of things. So rather than telling them, you know, use a problem-solving approach and trying to, in asking them, encouraging their thinking. And that's what I love about the exploratory. You know, yes, you need an adult who knows what they're doing to be in charge of that, absolutely, and maybe more than one adult, but more about exploring and, you know, thinking and coming up with the answers rather than being told.
Spirit. There always seems to be a new smartphone that people want to replace with the one they already have. And at the forefront of smartphone evolution is Apple. Oh my goodness, these things cost so much money. Who've had a big iPhone launch event earlier this week. Our own Richie G is our tech guru here. He stayed up to watch it and he's with me on the line to enlighten us all, hopefully in layman's terms. Richie, morning to you.
Okay. Hi, Wendy.
So what was this launch all about? What hour of the night were you staying up to watch it?
Well, actually, Wendy, it wasn't so bad. It was just Irish time. It was 6 p.m. in the morning, in the evening. So it wasn't so bad.
So that's grand. It was tea time. So what was the launch all about?
It was tea time indeed. Well, actually, the whole thing was actually high speed. That was the theme. So they're big on their new iPhone launch. And the new iPhone, well, it was like a whole two types of iPhone were launched. But they really went big on new 5G. Now, 5G is the year of 5G for sure. And in layman's terms, what does that mean? Well, quicker speeds, quicker gaming, and less lag when you're on a call, when you're like on an internet call. So more in real time.
I suppose which will be helpful for people who are doing a lot of Zooming and internet calls and Microsoft Teams and all the different platforms that you can use.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Of course, as well, it's also network dependent as well. So we'll just have to wait and see how 5G on the network.
And what are some of the other new features then, Richie?
Well, yeah, I mean, iPhone 12, as I said, they actually bringing out two versions of it, the iPhone 12 and the iPhone 12 Pro and Pro Max, but also the iPhone 12 and also the iPhone Mini as well. So a small version of the phone as well, which is quite exciting, I have to say.
Is it just going back to the size phones used to be?
Well, exactly. And it almost feels like they've listened to their customers, that people actually like don't want a big phone. They want a smaller phone which fits in the palm of your hand. And so the difference on the iPhone 12, entry kind of iPhone 12, 6.1 inch or 5.4 inch.
Okay, so how much is it going to cost?
Well, I mean, this is the question. In Ireland, you're looking at, it sounds quite expensive, and I think it's still quite expensive. You're looking at something like 899 euros, of course, or 799 euros for the basic model. Only, as far as I can see, only two networks in Ireland are saying coming soon. That's Vodafone and Three. Of course, we'll have to wait and see on contract.
The question is it worth it?
Well, this is one of the big questions. Now, I think if you want a phone, if you want to keep up the latest technology and you want a faster speeds, some of the features are a display shield. They call it ceramic shield, which claim is 4 times better drop performance. So if you're always dropping your phone, your display may last a little bit longer.
So that could be a good thing?
It could well be a good thing. Also, they seem to have gone back to the old iPhone 5 era with a squarer bezel and a squarer edge, which I kind of like the old iPhone 5 because it was square. It felt better to hold. It was less likely to slip out of your hand because of its rounded edges and all that sort of stuff. And I think it was a nice feel. So I think they seem to have gone back to that flat edge design. Like you said, is it worth splashing out for the cost? Well, I guess if you're on a high end contract and you're paying the top WAP for your phone monthly cost, where your network is you're subsidizing the cost of the phone through your network monthly charges, and you're due for an upgrade, well, go to your network and see what they offer you.
So,
sure.
Would you recommend upgrading to an iPhone over other types of devices then?
I think if you're on a contract and you're paying full WAP for your contract phone, and your contract is coming to an end, well, why not? You might as well upgrade to if you're on iPhone. If you want to stay with iPhone, you might as well upgrade. Or if you continue to pay the monthly charge at high WAC, you're not subsidizing your phone anymore, so you're wasting money, if that makes sense.
And for goodness sake, make sure you get a cover for that nearly 1,000 euro phone, the amount of cracked screens.
Absolutely, even though it has a 4 times better drop resistance. And of course, I think for most users, I would encourage people to wait, if you can, stay a generation or two behind, because let's face it, the older generation phones are going to come down in price in the coming months.
Yeah, and they're also just as good.
Absolutely, and also remember, Black Friday and Cyber Monday is coming.
So and also refurbished phones as well, Richie.
Absolutely. absolutely. Refurbished phones. Now, I always go refurbished phones, and I'm still on an iPhone 7 Plus, which I'm actually perfectly happy with. Now, of course, I would love to actually look for a refurbished phone for XR or XS or something like that.
Okay, we're getting 11. Too techie now, Richie. Thanks a million for that update.
Just
this morning.
The wireless charging.
Yeah, exactly. That was our technology expert there, Richie G, just updating us on the latest iPhone launches.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.